I asked you earlier on, before we started this interview, what you thought the worth was here, the value of everything was here, and you said it was priceless.
Priceless. You can't place a value on it. We haven't been insured because we just can't afford to.
No.
But the stuff, it is priceless because it's increasing more and more now, and the stuff is being exported as antiques.
Mm.
Even the ploughs are now. And it's pricing people out of, pricing private collectors out of the market if they're just collecting for themselves. And I think we get ours now because we are a charity museum and people are going to see it more.
Mm. So actually you don't have to buy anything. Most of your stuff is good.
We have bought things like the tractor we bought because we just couldn't see anyone giving it to us and it would be transported out of the area.
Mm.
We have bought ploughs, specialised ploughs.
Mm.
But we've perhaps bought it and said that we've bought it to a visitor and the visitor says, oh, that's bad. Here's some money.
Mm.
And we quite often get that happening. Like we decided the bottom buildings were to be concreted because they were just dust and people were getting and complaining about it. And we thought, well, A, for preservation things, a concrete floor would be useful. So we concreted it. And we had on this thing, we had a lecturer from Cambridge University, a local interior decorator, a farmer, a boy of eight, myself and my brothers,
mm-hmm.
a lady who kept a continuous stream of coffee growing, and a local builder. So we sort of really mixed them up, so to speak. Our bloke wandered down the garden and said, what you're on? And we said, oh, we've just raised enough money to build this. And he gave a big donation, you know, to help us on our way. And it's the feedback like that which keeps us going, really, I think. You know, people's generosity.
Have large companies been helpful to you?
Shell have. And sometimes you sort of get the odd can given here and there. And Wood Preserver, I think, we get.
Yeah.
But not as such. You know, what we would like, sort of so we could turn around and go in the council's face, would be a large company like Fison's or something like that to say, well, we'll sponsor it. And our publicity here would be great for a company like that because we get Fen Farmers coming, more and more and more, all coming, and they'd see it, you know. So if we could obtain a sponsorship or something which would help cover us, then we could develop. But as it is as such, you know, we're stuck to weekends and spare time, and it really is taking us over as a family and friends as well, you know. But it's a worthwhile thing when you consider what we've saved and what we continue to save.
Must give you a great deal of pleasure.
Pleasure and
I'm worried.
Sweat, blood and tears. It is. But there, you know, when you see what you've preserved and we're benefiting people like you listening to the tape, you know, because we've saved this stuff.
Yeah.
And visitors which come in the summer, you know, they appreciate it.
People come from not just this country either, Kevin.
Oh, no, we've had them from all over the place. Goes down really well with Americans being in the middle of the two air bases, see Milton Horn, Heath. They like it. We've had them from Russia, China, Australia. In fact, we've got a map in the new building, which is built up with little yellow dots.
Mm.
And on each yellow dot represents a person from another country. And it's now, you know, I think we do better by putting yellow dots where they haven't come from.
Yeah.
It's like change. Here we are now in front of a new display, which we've just built, of the farm machinery done up in its original condition. It's been painted up, restored, rebuilt, and now stands on a plinth, which has been built, set up above the ground, and all the machines are laid out as they would have been. Again, you get the problem here. Do you put a big bit of wire around? Because these are vicious machines. They've got teeth which crush cake, which is, you know, just a slab of stuff like a paving slab, which is in fact linseed cake, a mixture of things then pressed, and that crushes it. And there's teeth here which cut through mangles and that. And with adults, it's okay, you can leave them and perhaps only two or three will turn the handles. But I came near the last open day and we decided that one, they'd snap the wire, children had snapped the wire for one. We hadn't got it done quite. And these little kids were there trying to touch the blades, it goes round, and I went and flicked them off and said, hey, stop it, and went and wired it all up.
Mm.
But still, they snapped the wire, you know,
they could get the
and it's so annoying.
Yeah.
You know, we put this wire round, we wire it up, and they come and snap it again. You know, okay, they can't help it, the handle is a handle, and handles are meant to be turned in their eyes. But it's a bit sad when that happens, but there.
It's just going to take the time to break it off, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, when they break it off.
Well, actually,
so long.
Have you got here, Kim? Can you talk us through?
Well, we'll go from left to right, which is easier. At the end here, we have a sack lifter for the large sacks of oats, wheat, and that. Before you had the bulk transporters and that, they were transporting sacks in carts.
It's like an old-fashioned forklift truck, isn't it?
Like an old-fashioned forklift truck, manually operated with a ratchet system.
Yeah.
The sack is then put on off the floor, lifted about 2 inches, taken up and then put either on a man's back or a special lifter which you got down in the bottom buildings or directly onto the cart, and it's on wheels as well, so it can act like a lifting sack barrow in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Next to that we have a poultry grinder, in fact.
Cool.
Give, To give the rapid green bone cutter for poultry, Fellows and Bait Limited, makers Manchester, which is rather nice, to give chickens and raise ducks and their egg-laying, the egg-layers at the farm, extra calcium for the build-up of their shells. Mm. They used to grind up things like bones and cockles and things like that into a powder, and this was mixed with their feed, and they took it in with them, you see. Mm.
Why did they make the actual spokes inside the wheel this bendy shape? Was there any reason for that? I mean, this is...
Decoration in a way, but also to cast a straight spoke.
Mm.
When it's cast, the metal contracts, and if you get an uneven contraction with a straight spoke, it snaps, and your actual casting is snapped. But with a curved spoke, due to the extra length, plane, and cooling, they didn't snap as much.
Oh, it was interesting. Because I was going to say, you know, decorating something for ducks and chickens, you know.
They all seem to have that best shape.
Yeah,
spoke.
Yeah, that is basically why. But also, they did take great pride in their machines, and as you can see, these are painted up in the original colours, and we've got golds, bright reds, greens,
these
yellows.
These are the original colours?
These are the original colours, yeah. And I said to my father, I said, look, we want to stick a sign up saying these are the original colours, because it looks like we've just sort of decorated the house in really flamboyant colours and used up the paint on here,
because
it's not.
Many people like myself would have thought that stuff that they would have bought out, shall we say, 100 years ago, would have been like in browns and black colours, you know, no light colours at all.
Yeah.
These are in greens and yellows.
Yeah, well, you've seen the original sort of stereotype museum with the grubby cases and that, and do not lean on this case.
Probably, yeah.
We've done them up into their original colours, and I think a sign would have been of use here, and Dad said no, but I think it would, because they are such unusual colours, and they are so bright.
I agree with you, yeah. It looks as if you painted them, you know, deliberately to stand out, but if they are the original colours...
The one we're looking at now, the Unchokeable, made by Benton. Mm. This is a mangle cutter again. It's got teeth on this big blade which whirs around. And
what's it got inside? Can we have a look?
Well, inside it's got these teeth.
And this is on a big flywheel.
This is, in fact, a mincer, and it's teeth protruding from a flywheel.
Yeah.
And this is whirred round, and the mangle is wedged into an aperture at the base here, and it's grinded, and this stuff is dropped below by a simple shaft. It's in a bright green with red band around it, and the lettering all done in gold.
Mm.
You know,
yeah,
it just doesn't look.
Unchokeable.
It doesn't
you
look
even
right.
Read the patent on it. Like,
yeah.
8718.
Yeah. Moving on to.
This is a game of Ben. Well, this is a cake breaker. These are these slabs of cake, which Fen people will no doubt remember.
Mm-hmm.
Like a paving slab, they can be related to in size and that. These were built of ground wheat, oats, and linseed oil, because they have something called linseed cake to hold them together.
Mm.
These were put in the top, the handle whirred round, and a mesh of teeth, which will quite nicely crush your hand now. This is why you have to keep them wired up. Grinded this stuff up, ground it up, broke the cake structure as such, and was then fed to cattle and things like that. Next to that, we have the old Avery weighing machine. Still works quite nicely for weighing sacks, wheat as such, and it's got two lift-off handle things which increase the area of the base. So when weighing things like chaff, a bulky material but very light, you can weigh it quite accurately. Here, Bradford and Perkins, maker of Peterborough, another cake breaker but of a more advanced type with beautiful ornate castings on it, with a bigger handle than that for feeding cake. And this one... quite interesting, it's got a scoop at the bottom which filters out as such the hard nodules of cake and the dust, you know, so you can separate it. There's a sort of more advanced design. Next to that again, Bamford of Utoxeter. Almost exactly the same design, but it's a cake breaker again, and the amount of these have been broken up for scrap iron is incredible.
Yeah.
Really, it's quite remarkable.
In fact, it's driven by a belt, isn't it?
Yeah, this one is belt drive. Off one of the stationary engines. We sometimes have it going off one of the stationary engines in the shed, which we saw down at the base there. Again, a dangerous thing, because you've got loose belts there. There's no guard. No industrial laws brought out to say you have to have a guard there. All the cogs are exposed.
Yeah.
The belt has no belt guard on it at all. You know,
they've been very nice if you've got your fingers.
Oh, very nasty. And also, when demonstrating them, you have to put the rope about 2 or 3 yards away because of this danger and people working them.
Yeah.
They sort of say, well, good Lord, look, there's a small kid in there working that. Well, if you've been brought up in the area, you know full well what a belt will do and you know how to work it. And whilst we keep small children out, people of about 13, 14 here have a certain responsibility and they stick to it. And they take engines to bits and that. and learn how to get them to work. And they know the danger of these things. And yet adults, it's quite amazing. The small children will come along who have been at the museum, well, say small, sort of 11, 12, mm-hmm. and say, look, please don't go near there. And the fact that they've accepted this authority over the adult is amazing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the adult doesn't like to accept it, but then suddenly realise he's in the wrong.
Yeah.
And it is this danger aspect of the museum you've got to be careful of, because all our tools are so dangerous here.
Mm.
And you've got to be careful that small children don't get carried away.
Do you have notices outside that you accept no responsibility?
Yeah, well, as there's a note at the top of the garden, as soon as you enter it, we welcome visitors, not accidents, which, yeah. To the point. Oh, that's our latest project there. We've lifted the old cast iron seats off implements, tractors and that, with the letters all cast in, mounted them on a steel pole, and dotted them around like mushrooms for people to sit on, and we're just going past a bandstand which we've built here, which, in the summer we have bands playing on this, on the bandstand.
Cheese and wine party.
Hardly, but God. The band comes and attracts a different set of the public, you know, to come and listen to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite nice because the acoustics here are really brilliant because we've got buildings all the way round.
Mm.
And it really throws the sound out into the garden. It's really nice, you know, you can come on a glorious summer day and there's a band playing and there's a blacksmith working and that. It really is great. You know, people come, listen to the band, there are seats dotted around, there are various mushrooms, our seats which we just built,
like
dotted around.
Like
with the band, it is quite nice.
Visit the blacksmith and the wheelwright shop. A wide range of people were involved in the construction of that building. A local farmer heard that sufficient pantiles to make a fine roof were about to be broken up to fill in the holes in a fend row. The people at the Havner Museum saved them. a bank manager needed to have an old house demolished on his building site, and when asked, donated the timber in it for the use as walling. On being told about the project, a building firm allowed any suitable wood to be taken from the site of the old threshing tackle sheds at Streatham. A bricklayer travelled from Buckden on a cold winter's morning to build the forge chimney, and another from Chettisham put in the footings. The rest of the work was carried out by friends of the museum. All this was voluntary. It is to the thanks of such enthusiastic workers that the entire building was constructed for little more than £70. The building has a pitch roof and is of a traditional pan tile effect. The walls are of feather edge boards or cladding. The weather vane depicting a smith and his apprentice at work was specially designed for the shop by the local blacksmith, who gives his demonstrations there regularly. The forge is brick-built and is equipped with pear-shaped bellows, which gave years of service at the threshing tackle works in Haddon. There is also to be seen cylindrical bellows, which were donated to the museum by an officer in the Navy who owned property in Orwell. The lathe at the wheelwright's end of the shop came from Keddington. It was repaired by a woodturner from Willingham and made to work by a traddle, the style of Edwardian sewing machines, and by a pulley system. Using a beautifully made wooden wheel, which had been part of a mechanism at the old brewery in Ely, small boys of today loved to be asked to turn the wheel, much as they did years ago when the wheelwright really needed such power in order to carry out his everyday work. The work of the village blacksmith and that of the wheelwright was often interrelated. A wooden cartwheel, which has a tar in the form of a band of metal, is an example of work involving both trades. It seemed appropriate, therefore, to make this building dual purpose, so the tools to do with both trades could be displayed and used there. Let's go into the blacksmith shop now, and firstly we'll hear about the blacksmith and wheelwright shop from Kevin Delanoy, and then we'll have a word with the blacksmith, Mr. Keith Patterson.
I'm Shire Ingenuity again. This was once a house in the middle of some fen.
This was?
Yeah, this blacksmith shop was. We were given the house, and the day after Boxing Day, on Christmas, off we all went with a lorry and two or three carloads. And
It's about, 10 foot wide, 12 foot wide by about 20 feet long, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite a big shop.
Wooden clad.
The amusing tale was, the bloke said, it's a blue house down Sam Fen, no one's living in it. So we went and saw this house, all wooden construction, rip, 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 and down it came. And we just left with this chimney, and some mug said, what happens if there are two blue houses down Sam Fen? And we all belted in this car and drove up down this road, but we had got the right house. And this has been reconstructed into the actual blacksmith shop. We can go in and have a look if you like.
That'd be marvellous.
Which would give a better impression.
Well, now we're standing inside the blacksmith's shop, aren't we, in front of the old forge. What's this over here on your left, Kevin?
Well, these are the actual bellows, which actually work the forge.
And these still work?
These still work, and we use them on open days to actually power the forge. Rather a nice sound there.
And this is blowing the sound into the forge.
Indeed so, yes, and that gives the extra heat to heat the iron up so it's easy to bend and manipulate into shape. Now walking through the blacksmith shop, we go past another set of bellows, which works so you can have two blacksmiths on the same forge, and we're now into a wheelwright shop. The wheelwright actually made the cart wheels, the spokes, the fellies, and the hubs. And he was using a joke with the blacksmith, and the blacksmith used to make the outer rim on this machine here.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually made
the
rim.
Which is steel, isn't it?
Which is steel, yes.
Big steel band.
And that's the machine it's being held in now isn't called what's called an upsetting machine. If the actual metal was made too long, mm-hmm. then instead of having to cut it, re-splice it and shorten the steel, you put in this upsetting machine, squash the metal up to make the actual less. It was then taken outside onto a big cast iron platform, which is set into the ground with a hole in the middle, and the wooden part of the wheel was laid on this platform, and the red hot tire was carried out, put on, adjusted in place, and then water poured over it, and it pulled and contracted and made the wheel tight. Mm. Here we have the lathe from the actual shop, which we rescued from a blacksmith's shop, Cullen Wheelwright's shop, in Suffolk, and this was hoisted down and transported back here and set up again. And it gives the, you know, it shows people the type of materials and tools they were using in those in that era.
They look very primitive, but...
Oh, they are, but they were very effective. They used them, they knew how to use them exactly like the old, the pit saws and the big bow saws and that. They all knew how to use them, the adz, or for manipulating the wood. You know, once, they were very ingenious in these days and they knew how to use them. And they worked it all out. In fact, there's some tools on this bench here, which we don't know what they are, and so we've left them around for the actual visitors to see, and sometimes we're sort of standing around, and they say,
there.
Good Lord, you've got one of those, and we say, yes, we have, what is it, you know? We've got the wheelbarrow wheels and things like that.
And these massive saws, does it take two people to work these?
Oh, yeah, they're the two. They're actually pit saws, they are.
Yeah.
Top pit man and the bottom.
All the gentlemen's implements. There's been some work done on these, I should imagine.
Oh, yeah, the desk is getting a bit cluttered up because our collection is increasing of those. Here we have three wheels come to that, which have been rescued off a seed drill and brought in to show people the actual final result, which is a rather elegant wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And the patterns there used by the wheelwright to achieve the same fairly length and that throughout the wheel.
I see. They're like a jig thing, aren't they?
They're like a jig, yes, yeah. A pattern which you can then go around and make sure they're all the same so you don't get a lopsided wheel.
Oh, marvellous. It's no wonder how they got a wheel completely.
Here we have a small portable forge, which is in working
the
order.
The bellows still work. Oh.
For outside shoeing, you can transport the forge there and light up and do your shoeing.
And who made this? It was Headley and Edwards, makers...
Cambridge. It's a weighing machine to weigh 100 weight, with a nice wooden box frame and the...
Still work?
Weighing. Oh, yes, of course, yes. We sometimes use that, in fact. And here's a poker stand, which we use a forge now for making pokers to raise money for upkeep, and various forms of pokers yet to be painted, I note. Another job there, never short of jobs.
Oh, I should imagine not. And Kay Patterson, hand-forged ironwork, is that...
That is Mr. Patterson, the resident blacksmith, so to speak, but he's an ambulance man, in fact. Mm. And so there are demonstrations when the ambulance men aren't on shift work, but he's very regular, and in the meantime I'm learning, and a friend of mine, so we're gradually picking it up from him, and we sort of got to the stage where we can make pokers and brackets and tongs and things like that, samples of which are lying around all over the place.
Sort of family thing, and we just carried on with it.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, I just sort of keep my hand in.
Is there any call for that as a profession today, though?
Oh, yeah, there is a fair bit. There's more for shoeing now and a lot of things. Mm. There's quite a lot of wrought ironwork jobs around, but there's not many people prepared to pay the price, you know.
Mm.
If you want sort of traditional ironwork done like they have in the colleges and that, college gates and things like that. Talking in terms of what, say, £50 or £60 a sort of square yard or something like that, you know. It's quite expensive.
Well, you don't actually price the whole job, you in fact work on an area.
They normally do them is on sort of so much a you know, sort of square yard or something. Yeah. And then you can sort of work your scrolls and that out from that.
Actually, you've got some clothing over there that you you sell to
get
the museum going.
Yeah.
They're very difficult to make, but they take very long.
No, not really. They're not too bad actually, because we do so many of them that, you know, they sort of take in nature.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only thing.
You're heating the metal up now.
Yes. Well, really, for this size, it don't really need warming up, you know. No. You can nearly pull it cold, but it makes a better job of it. Take the spring out of it, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful atmosphere, isn't it?
It really is, isn't it?
Blacksmith. Mm-hmm. You've got all the original. I remember when I was a lad, actually, my father was in the RAF and we were stationed at Coningsby, and there was a local village there, and the blacksmith was actually still in business.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was
about
15 years ago.
Around, really. If they, you know, it's just a matter of,
yeah.
I suppose, with these wrought iron gate merchants, you can all get one sort of just thrown together like for £2.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever been tempted to sort of take this up as a business, or?
I used to do it as a business in the village. Mm. Until that was when the 3-day week was on, you know.
Yeah.
And I sort of carried on, and that was sort of, you know, that was hard going. So I sort of gave up then.
Yes. So it's very hard work, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite.
Very hot,
especially in the summertime. I mean, I used to. When I used to work for the father, and then that was no problem really, because there was what was the four of us in the workshop, and in the summertime, you know, there was plenty of work to do, but you also, you could start a good time in the morning, leave off about 3 o'clock in the afternoon if you wanted to.
Yeah.
How long have they been going in the village?
My grandfather started it off. I suppose they've been going, 70 or 80 years, I suppose. You know, through the family, like.
What was his name?
That was Mr. Patterson. We worked, actually, we worked with my uncle, and that was, I used to run under the name of Turner's, because that was the original name of the blacksmith shops, you know.
Yeah.
They were the ones who my grandfather sort of bought them off. But they traded under that name because they'd still got all the old bill heads and everything the same, you know.
Mm.
People in the villages knew him as Turner's, the blacksmith, and that was just carried on, you know. They used to have a forge in Sudbury, Turner's.
I always thought those were sort of formed, you know, around a set pattern, but obviously
they are, actually,
most just done by hand, by the eye.
You can use that because you can pull them. You can actually roll them around an handle, but if you want to do many of them, you can just quickly do them like that.
Yeah.
You've got to make that in the first place, anyway.
You've got to make the form yourself before you start making the iron work.
Well, when I used to work myself, we had about 20 different ones around. All we done was made a small one, then pulled another one around that, another one around that, until you've got one for every size, you know.
Nice.
What do you do? Just lay your coke on the forge.
On there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
does
coal.
Does it cool? It's coal.
Yeah. There's a special coal called smithy nuts.
Smithy nuts, yeah.
Really?
You also make weather vanes, I notice.
Yeah, we've got that one on the top there.
Yeah.
There's one on the actual
roof, yeah. Other black here, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
You actually made that?
Yeah, I done that one. That was ages ago.
Yeah, it was when you were in business, wasn't it?
Yeah. We've done them down there.
I noticed actually you've got a collection of spanners on the wall there. Were they actually made here or in a forge, or were they just for display?
They're just a sort of display thing, really.
They're in fact traction engine spanners.
Yeah, they're huge, aren't they?
Sort of about 1.5 long.
Mm.
Doing an inch and 8 bolts.
They open up to about, 2.5 inches, something.
Yeah.
And finally, to round up this little interview, what about the sound of the finished product? The finished product of the blacksmith, that is. Yes, a good sound there of the horse beating its path along the roadway.
Into what we call our top building, which is the original garden shed we've moved into. This has since had an extension put on it, and we're now standing in that extension.
Which is about, what, 10 foot by 40, isn't it?
Yeah, which is now natural history. A section through a tree, which is done rather nicely on a time scale, and the tree is planted in 1766 and was felled in 1976 through Dutch elm disease. It's about, what, three 3 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you some idea, it's got American Independence in 1776, and the nicest comparison is man's first flight in 1906.
Mm.
The tree lived through that, and actually saw a man land on the moon the same time as the funnel museum was started.
Mm.
Yeah, it's got the proportion of the First World War, man's first car.
Yeah,
and these built. Actually marked up on the lines in the tree itself.
Yeah, marked on the annular rings.
It lasted, what, it was planted
1766.
210
years. And
felled
in 1976.
Yeah. It's 210 years old, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution, opening of the London Underground, telephone invented, you know, and this tree has lived through it all.
Yeah.
And for a visual display for small children, it's really great because they can imagine the tree growing and the length of time, especially with the idea of this man's first flight and man on the moon, is such a short, it's only, what, about... Man's first flight, man on the moon.
6 inches. No.
Less than that, about 4 inches in this tree's life that man has made that, you know, and technology increasing so much, and yet the ironic thing is we can't cure Dutch elm disease, but we can land on the moon. Over here we have what's called our archaeological section.
Mm-hmm.
This is all laid out as the only way archaeology can be done, in glass cases.
Mm.
We can't get around it anyway, but it's all nicely labelled, and the cases are fairly low for children so they can see as well. We have here vertebrae of various animals laid out, pliosaur vertebrae, coal measure, muscle band, and all things like this laid out.
Some of this stuff was found the old brickworks, or the old clay pits.
The old clay pits in Haddenham, yeah, dinosaur pliosaur bones and things like that were all fished out. And then we have at the end here mammoth tusks, and mammoth teeth, in fact. Mm. We have a mammoth molar there, a molar for the mammoth. What is it, about 4 inches long? And about 6 inches high by about 3 inches wide. And imagine a toothache in that.
And these are the tusks and teeth of a mammoth elephant. And they were found, could you tell us where they were found?
Well, mainly from brick pits, you see, because there you've got the right conditions and the depth of mining, the era of Barrington, St Ives and Landbeach.
So there were dinosaurs standing where we are now?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Mammoth as such. That's a mammoth tooth there, isn't it?
It's about 8 inches long by about 5 inches wide. Yeah.
They have big teeth. They really are huge. And in fact, in Russia, they've just found in through the ice in Siberia, an explorer was sort of trekking through the area and found the ear of a mammoth. And sure enough, attached to the other end of it was a woolly mammoth, a complete woolly mammoth frozen, preserved in this ice.
Yeah.
So the Russians preserve things really well. They rushed a container lorry over there, like the big refrigeration lorries, which Bird's Eye have now, but a really large one.
Mm.
They hacked this mammoth out of the ice, took it back to Moscow, peeled all the ice off, and have now got in a refrigerated museum a complete mammoth standing there. And it is huge. It's a baby mammoth, this thing is, and it's really ginormous. And they've managed to analyse the actual structure of this thing and found it died through blood poisoning. We've written to the Russian embassy, and they've directed the letter to Leningrad in a hope that we can get a set of photographs, well, I'm sure they'll oblige, so that small visitors and children can actually see the size of a small mammoth compared with a man, because they really were huge in proportion to the elephants we have now.
They were bigger.
Well, you know, they were much bigger than an African elephant. They were huge.
Mm.
And we need to consider these parts of these tusks here. They were much bigger than an elephant tusk.
Mm.
And these things, this was a small mammoth that they found. Here we have things, Roman remains and tiles, a tile led dug up from Streatham from the area itself, because a lot of the land is above the flood level.
Mm.
And the fact that when the Fairs wasn't draining, you know, Harry with the Wake and all that, there were Roman settlements on the high ground. In fact, Bedlam Farm, just down the road from us towards Aldworth, there are Roman settlements being found there. And various sorts of Roman stuff have been picked up in the area. Some of which have been labelled in that. Here we have Sutton sheep bells, which my father actually found one, and spindle wells, the weights for spinning machines and that, have actually been picked up.
When you say a settlement, I mean, is that a fort, or would there just be a family live there? Or
settlement? There could be a fort. It depends on what's found. You see here, look, here we have laid out Bronze Age and various other things found. And when you look there, look, Bronze Age spearhead.
Yeah.
Well, it's a work of art, that spearhead. It's about, 4 inches long, tapered to the shaft and the actual head of the spear, and that was found in Hathenham. And these Mesolithic and Neolithic axes, primitive man, have dug up the ceremonial axes, the Bronze Age axe, the sword there.
In fact, there's an arrowhead in making those flint spearheads too, isn't there? I mean, couldn't do it.
The art of flint knapping, which still goes on at Brandon in Suffolk. So we've actually got the bits set from the old flintlock musket still down in one of the museums down there. These have been dug up and given to us. In fact, there's a really fine example here found at Waterbeach. It was found by a local gypsy who was potato picking, found it and realised, you know, it was of interest and brought it to us. And we got them here, look, from Streatham, part of an antler pick from Grimes Graves, scrapers, leaf arrowheads from Littlebore, a lot from Littlebore's area. Mm. Really fine axes there. Mesolithic flake there. It's fell on a beet harvester down in Adam and Fenn. Mm. So primitive man must have been around this area. And we've catalogued these finds with the archaeological section in Cambridge, and gradually they're building up a composite picture of finds within the area.
Mm. It's marvellous to think that these things have come from where we are now, isn't it?
Indeed,
In other museums, you find things from away from the district.
Doing in the local locality, here we have a lovely display set up called The Lost World, which is lit up with a nice eerie light for small children on a low level, with these models laid out of dinosaurs in their habitat. Here we have querns and that. I don't know if you've heard about querns before. They're for grinding wheat.
Yeah, the big stone.
Big oval type stone with a hole going through and holes in the side, standing what, about 9 inches high and about a foot across, cylinder type thing. And due to the action of the rocks grinding it ground the wheat, there are various forms of quern here. Someone comes from Denny Abbey. There's one here, a Roman quern, which has a rather unusual texture to it. And here, saddle querns, where the wheat was just laid on a hollow curved bit out of the rock and stone was rubbed over it, more primitive type.
Were these actually in this shape, or were they worked into this
shape? They were worked into this shape specifically for grinding corn. And these, a lot of these, they are like part of a quern they found in Hillrow. That is really local. And it's, because it's local, it really, you know, we're dealing with this area, and it hits you that all these things have been found in this area. Whereas if you went to a large museum, it would have them from a large area. But here, in specific relation to where you're standing, you can sometimes see the places where they've been found because we're on the hill.
The thing is with schools today, if they explain about the history of what it was like around here, you know, in the Iron Age and what have you, they tend to make the man look as if he was... All he used to do was riding about on these wicker boats. And he was primitive. And, he was a very primitive man. They don't explain that he would have the technology to make his own...
Yeah, the technology, though, compared with us, you see, we've got from this primitive Roman quern and these primitive axes, which really all they are is a shaped lump of stone, to a microprocessor, the latest microprocessor. Mm. And the fact is, you know, you can come in here, the first building you come into, and it's got these Roman querns, and probably one of the last ones you get out of it's got a microprocessor.
Yeah.
We've covered the area.
A lovely day it was as well, and a lovely museum to come and look around. And people are most welcome to look around, aren't they?
Yeah, first Sunday every month. We'll always be here, rain, snow, shine. Mm. We're here. You're very welcome to come.
Well, Kevin Delanoy, we'd like to thank you very much for showing us.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
In 1979, Mr. Mike Delanoy Sr. announced the closure of the Haddenham Farm Museum. This was partly because the running costs and the time that had to be given to the upkeep of the museum were both astronomical. Upon hearing this, Arles MP, Mr. Clement Freud, set about to set up a board of trustees to help in the running of the museum. I asked Mr. Freud a few questions about the importance of the Farmland Museum.
Why do you think it is important to have such a place as the Farmland Museum open to the public?
Well, I think the public, while they live today, should really bear in mind what used to go on, what their parents did, what their grandparents did, what happened in the village of Haddenham, what happened in the Fens in the beginning of the century, in the last century. And there seems to be no better place than to have it in the sort of Fen surroundings of the Farmland Museum, with the dedicated affection and love and care that is given to it at the moment.
And I understand that you have yourself played a part in keeping the museum open.
Well, I've certainly encouraged them, and I've collected money where I could, and have helped them where I was able. And we've now got a local motor car manufacturer, well, agent, to put up some money, and a few supporters have contributed. I've done what I could.
What is your personal view of the fact that one family, the Delanoys, were able to achieve so much from so very small beginnings?
Well, I think it's very impressive. I compliment them. When I first met them, I think Craig had started the museum as a sort of project at school or hobby. It really shows that if your dedication is there, the sky is the limit. Or the Farmland Museum. It's just the beginning.
And its future role, what do you see in its prospect for the future?
Well, like all small museums, one hopes very much that it'll get encouragement from the local people, endorsement from the authorities, and perhaps a little largesse from government. You know, as a nation, we spend less money on the arts per head of the population than any other nation in Europe. And I think it would be very splendid if the government could be made to believe that the arts and museums and theatre and concerts, the living arts particularly, are a very much better investment than building barbed wire fences to keep people in when, instead of breaking windows, they might come to a museum and spend their time happily and profitably.
Do you agree that the museum should be kept in Haddon? Would you like to see it kept in Haddon?
Oh, I mean, every village should have one, but as Haddon has got one, by all means leave it there. Yes. You can't transfer museums the way you transfer football players or chairman of the British Steel Corporation.
No. But one thing that impresses me when I go to Haddon on an open day is the variety of museums and exhibitions that they have in that village.
Yes, I think like all good museums, they go out of their way to focus the attention on different parts, as you say, on the variety of relics and memento that they have from different ages.
And the last question, what impression would you like to think that a visitor to the museum has in his mind when he leaves?
Well, a museum should stimulate interest. I hope that he will look at the museum and say, oh, I didn't know that. I must read about this. I must look this up. I must learn some more about that. Or I must get my kids to come and have a look at it because it'll teach them something. And it'll teach it enjoyably.
So, from the small beginnings in 1969, we've seen that the Farmland Museum has developed in the way described by Kevin. It has involved many people in a great variety of ways, in the generous giving of gifts, of building materials, in labour, in transporting larger items, and in the upkeep of existing displays. Above all, people have given their time, perhaps the most valuable commodity of all.